This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
We draw your attention to verses 54 and 55 of chapter Araf from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Ali Asghar Burumand.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Inna رَبَّكُمُ اللَّهُ الَّذِي خَلَقَ السَّمَاوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضَ فِي سِتَّةِ أَيَّامٍ خَلَقَ السماوات والأرض في ستة أيام ثم استوى على العرش ثم استوى على العرش الليل النهار يطلبه حثيثا والشمس والقمر والنجوم مسخرات ألا له الخلق والأمر تبارك الله رب العالمين ادعوا ربكم تضرعا ادعوا ربكم تضرعا وخفية إنه لا يحب المعتدين صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Surely, your Lord is Allah, who created the heavens and the earth in six periods of time, and He is firm in power. He throws the veil of night over the day, which it pursues incessantly. And He created the sun and the moon and the stars, made subservient by His command. Surely, His is the creation and the command. Blessed is Allah, the Lord of the worlds. Call on your Lord humbly and secretly. Surely, He does not love those who exceed the limits.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines this hour: U.S. President Donald Trump again questions the integrity of Tuesday's presidential election as his Democratic rival maintains a solid national lead in the polls. The death toll from a strong earthquake hitting western Turkey rises to 81 as rescue workers are searching for survivors. And Azerbaijan's president says his troops will go to the end if negotiations with Armenia over the disputed Nagorno-Karabakh region fail. Welcome to the program. As I said in the headlines, U.S. President Donald Trump has once again vowed to defy the American election, while his Democratic rival Joe Biden has urged his supporters to take back democracy. Trump, while sprinting through five swing states, cast doubt on the integrity of the polls, saying a vote count after the election day would be a terrible thing. He warned that his lawyers might get involved on November the 3rd. Americans have voted unprecedentedly through mail-in ballots that could take days or weeks to be counted in some states. Trump has said repeatedly without evidence that mail-in votes are prone to fraud. A last-minute scramble came as polls show Biden maintains his overall lead. Meanwhile, Biden denounced the alleged harassment of one of his campaign buses by Trump supporters on a Texas highway. The FBI has launched an investigation into the incident. Well, as the U.S. awaits for the election results during the pandemic, President Trump's allegations of fraud have increased the likelihood of epic post-election court fights. The two camps prepare for the battle of lawsuits. Our correspondent brings us the story from Florida.
For those who remember the turbulent and unprecedented vote counting battle in Florida that polarized the United States in 2000, causing the Supreme Court to decide the outcome, it may be that starting this coming Tuesday, they will be able to relieve the same emotions, only this time much more intense.
American elections are actually done state by state. Each of the 50 states and Washington, D.C. can make their own rules on the polling places, the ballots, and the rules for counting them. And so I do think that we're going to have uncertainty and some legal challenges, maybe not out of Florida, but especially looking at Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and North Carolina, three key battleground states, which already have cases that have gone to the Supreme Court.
The Supreme Court actually has a long history of allowing for certain systems of injustice to continue. It took a number of years before slavery was abolished. It took a number of years before you had the ending of segregation as well. And so I think one of the things I think we have to question first is the integrity of the Supreme Court.
The current president has repeatedly said that the elections will be fraudulent and that he will not recognize his adversary's victory if that is how the electoral boards decide. Specialists indicate that the demands and the uncertainty will occur in November and at least until January.
President Trump has been putting forward this idea that of voter fraud, and in 2018, the same allegation was brought forward by the Republican Party that there was a voter fraud. And after an investigation was conducted, it was found that there was very minimal levels of voter fraud, that to the point it was insignificant. And so I think this notion that voter fraud is occurring is actually a fraud itself, because the real story is actually about voter suppression.
The U.S. is accustomed to declare a winner on the evening of the election day. But this year's elections can still linger for days or even weeks as states finalize vote tallies or conduct recounts. Ronnie Carvello, reporting from Miami.
On news coming out of the U.S., top U.S. health expert Anthony Fauci has issued an urgent plea for a change in Washington's policy on the coronavirus pandemic. In an interview with the Washington Post, Fauci warned that the U.S. is headed for, quote, a whole lot of hurt unless it makes it an abrupt change, or actually unless it makes an abrupt change in its health practices. He said the country could not possibly be positioned more poorly ahead of the cold weather and the flu season. But the White House rejected the warning as unacceptable and against all norms, accusing Fauci of choosing to play politics just before the election. Now, Trump insists the country is rounding the turn on the virus, even as over 9.2 million Americans have contracted COVID-19 and more than 200,000 have unfortunately died of it. Colleen Campbell says Donald Trump is trying to downplay the severity of the COVID-19 crisis in the U.S.
He's on pretty much a campaign trying to disprove how serious COVID-19 is. And, of course, this is because he wanted to spell out the narrative that there is really nothing serious affecting America, and that our economy is strong, everybody's doing well, and that people were essentially better now than they were 4 years ago. But the opposite is true. We have a lot of people who have died from COVID-19. We have a floundering economy. We have a general feeling of malaise as people are tired of the up and down of Washington politics, being sequestered and quarantined, and still the rate of infections has gone up. The cases of coronavirus cases have gone up. And of course, the huge loss of jobs as people file for unemployment. An estimated 750,000 people filed for unemployment just last week alone. And because the number of cases continues to rise in the country, many people don't believe that the economy will bounce back to the pre-COVID-19 levels for the next several months or so.
The death toll from Friday's powerful earthquake in the western Turkey city of Izmir rises to 81. Turkish authorities say 79 people lost their lives in Izmir, while two others died in the Greek island of Samos. Rescue efforts are underway to find the remaining survivors beneath the debris. Turkish Disaster and Emergency Authority says over 960 people were injured in the quake. The rescue groups have provided over 3,500 tents and 13,000 beds to temporarily sheltered victims. A powerful 7-magnitude trembler rocked Turkey and Greece on Friday, causing a lot of damage. Azerbaijan's president says his troops will go to the end if negotiations with Armenia over the disputed Nagorno-Karabakh region fail. Ilham Aliyev said he wants to resolve the conflict through talks that would result in the withdrawal of ethnic Armenian forces from Nagorno-Karabakh. Otherwise, he added, Azerbaijan will continue fighting to restore its territorial integrity. Aliyev made the comment in a meeting with Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlut Çavuşoğlu in Baku. Azerbaijan and Armenia have been engaged in clashes over Nagorno-Karabakh for more than a month now. three ceasefire attempts have failed to stop the fighting, with both sides accusing one another of violations. On Friday, they agreed on a series of measures aimed at diffusing tensions and refraining from targeting civilians. Tens of thousands of people have once again marched in the Belarusian capital to demand President Alexander Lukashenko leave power. Police fired warning shots and used stun grenades to disperse protesters. More than 200 people were arrested. Demonstrators have flooded the capital for 12 straight weeks since August, when Lukashenko won the presidential election in a landslide. The opposition candidate, who has since fled the country, says the vote was rigged. Several people have died in the post-election violence. Lukashenko, who is backed by Russia, has accused the U.S. of inciting violence in the country. Infections and deaths from coronavirus keep surging in Europe, where fresh restrictions are in place to stem the spread of the disease. France, that is under lockdown, reported more than 46,000 new infections in the past 24 hours. That pushes France's total case tally to over 1.4 million. Its total fatalities have surpassed 37,000. Official data showed that the number of coronavirus patients in intensive care units has also surged in France. Meanwhile, Russia reported a record daily increase of more than 18,650 on Sunday. That brings the country's national tally to over 1.63 million. In the UK, the government says a new four-week lockdown across England will be extended if necessary.
We will always take a decision in the national interest based on evidence. The best information we have...
Is that yes?
Yes.
So it could be extended?
Yes.
National?
National lockdown in England is set to come into force on Thursday. It was announced following warnings that hospitals could be overwhelmed within weeks. The UK has recorded over 160 new deaths and over 23,000 new infections in the last 24 hours. Daily infections have kept rising in Italy as well. The country on Saturday registered its highest ever daily infection tally with almost 32,000 cases. Health Minister Roberto Speranza has called the new data terrifying. He says Italy has 2 days to approve further restrictions. In other parts of the continent, that is Europe, countries such as Portugal and Austria have also announced lockdown measures. Well, as I said, Austria joins European states entering into a second lockdown as the continent faces a massive second wave of COVID-19 infections. So on that story, we have Homa Lesgi in Vienna.
Starting on Tuesday, November 3rd, there will be a second lockdown in Austria to contain a massive second wave of COVID-19 infections across Europe. All events will be cancelled. Hotels, restaurants and bars will close, and a curfew will be in place between 8 p.m. and 6 a.m. Universities and classes for older students will switch to distance learning. Chancellor Sebastian Kurz told The Nation, "We will have to do without a lot of what makes up our lives."
If the number of new infections continues to grow so rapidly, Austria's healthcare system, although it's one of the best in the world, will soon be out of capacity.
The country's health minister says Austria is in a race against time.
The turnaround must be achieved by mid-November. Otherwise, doctors will have to choose who to treat via triage. If we act now, we can gradually begin reopening at the beginning of December.
Health authorities are worried about the repercussions of an explosion of infections in October. On Saturday, more than 5,300 new infections were reported across the country, five times more than just 2 weeks ago. As a tourist and sport nation, Austria is affected particularly hard by the restrictions. The government has announced that affected businesses will get 80% of their revenue from the same month last year reimbursed if they keep all their employees on the payroll. Anyone not following the new rules could face fines reaching up to 1,500 euros. The question that everyone wants an answer for is when all this will end. The definitive end of all measures will only be possible when there's an effective vaccine, experts say. Austria's chancellor told the people he's confident they can have a normal summer again in 2021. Homa Lesgi, Vienna.
Now, Iran has launched large-scale air drill in the central province of Isfahan. The main goal of the military exercise is to enhance the country's military preparedness in the face of inbound attacks. Youssef Jalali attended the event and filed this report.
This is not a real war, but it's a chance for young Iranian pilots to test their prowess in real-time war scenarios. These awe-inspiring moves are part of an annual military exercise dubbed the Defenders of Vilayet Skies. Staged by the Iranian Army's Air Force, the massive maneuver engages all of the Iranian Army's air bases across the country.
The drill is a routine practice of defense where simulated attacks are devised and our forces, especially the young ones, will be tested in warlike situations. This drill is the ninth edition of an annual maneuver called Defenders of Velayat Skies that is hosted by Shahid Babai Air Base.
The two-day drills saw the use of interceptor aircraft, fighter bombers, medium and heavy transport airplanes, patrol aircraft, as well as reconnaissance and bomber drones. The fighters included long-range Sukhoi Su-24, F-14 fighters, and Boeing 747 and 707 tanker aircraft. The fighters are set to strike their mock targets some 250 kilometers away. Iranian Army officials say the main goal of the maneuvers is to enhance the country's preparedness in the face of potential threats in the region.
Our young personnel at the Air Force, including pilots and aerospace experts, have successfully carried out their assigned missions so far in the drill. This is a chance for the Iranian Army's Air Force to boost its readiness to protect the skies of the Islamic Republic against any possible aggression.
The military practice included air-to-air shooting, air-to-surface bombardment using smart heavy and semi-heavy bombs, radar and thermal missiles, as well as homemade rockets and bombs. The drills also used Iran's latest achievements in electronic warfare, including long-range search radars capable of detecting missile launches, stealth aircraft and drones.
The Iranian Army's Air Force says this drill is a chance to both test the latest Iranian homegrown weapons and enhance the country's preparedness against potential threats. Army officials here say the success of this maneuver sends a message of security to Iran's neighbors. Youssef Jalali from the location of the drill.
In Algeria, the turnout of a referendum on a revised constitution has been a historic low of 23.7%. The result is a blow to the government that aimed to use the vote as a platform to quell persistent civil unrest and neutralize HIROC, the main protest movement in the country. The revised constitution would see term limits for the president and promise new rights. However, HIROC movement called for a boycott of the vote, saying the new text is simply a change of facade. The youth-led movement launched huge demonstrations in early 2019 and kept them up for more than a year until the coronavirus pandemic forced their suspension. The current government of President Abdelmadjid Tebboune came to power after massive protests ousted longtime President Abdelaziz Bouteflika. With the anniversary of the birthday of Islam's holy prophet Muhammad just around the corner, people from all walks of life are attending different ceremonies to mark the auspicious event. Take a look.
Afghans are marking the arrival of the birthday anniversary of the Prophet Muhammad under the name of Unity Week, at a time when Islamophobia is growing in some parts of the world and amid French President Emmanuel Macron's recent insulting comments about the Holy Prophet of Islam, people in Afghanistan are attending ceremonies like this one in Kabul as a show of respect and love for the Prophet of over 2 billion Muslims.
I'm here to show my strong support and deep love for the beloved Holy Prophet. Fortunately, we can attend different ceremonies that deepen our understanding of Islam.
We don't care about insulting words of individuals like Macron. This is especially because our leader, the Holy Prophet, has ordered us to be logically patient. Instead, we mark Unity Week to show how the followers of Islam's Holy Prophet ignore tensions and approve unity.
Based on Islamic beliefs, the arrival of Unity Week, as its title suggests, serves as a big opportunity for Muslims to once again return to the main teachings of the Prophet Muhammad, such as a strengthening unity among Muslims. Some others believe that the arrival of the birthday anniversary of Islam's Holy Prophet is also an opportunity for mankind to review the life and words of the Prophet Muhammad to see the real face of Islam.
Unity Week, in fact, brings unity among nations and Islamic societies like Afghanistan. I'm proudly saying it that Afghanistan is one of the leading countries of the Muslim world when it comes to the issue of Islamic Brotherhood.
I call on your audience to please study the true life and words of Islam's Holy Prophet. Yes, this is too important for anybody who is seeking truth about Islam and its honorable and holy leader, the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him.
Besides calling for boosting Islamic Brotherhood among Afghans, those attending ceremonies marking Unity Week say the cementing of national unity among Afghans is one of the musts associated with Unity Week. As observers say, the best way to lead the nation to a real national unity is to remove the obstacles on the way of the ongoing peace talks between the government and Taliban in the Qatari capital, Doha. Sayed Amin Alami, Kabul.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrents fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for thee. I ask thee concerning the complaints of thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among thy servants, of a handmaid from among thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask thee, O he who owns all objects of need which are granted by his will and hastened to his desire, that thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that thou willst, and givest me mercy from thee. Forgiveness decreases thee not, and giving injuries thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from thee: the facility to obey thee at its beginning, and the favor of thy forgiveness at its end. O he who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
The Limelight. World Health Organization's European Regional Director Hans Kluge said in a meeting with European health ministers, Europe is at the epicenter of this coronavirus pandemic once again. Hans Kluge added, at the risk of sounding alarmist, I must express a very real concern. Kluge said that deaths have increased by more than 30% in the past week, hospitalizations have reached their highest level since spring. Meanwhile, daily COVID-19 cases in the United States reached a record high on Thursday, 29th of October, with experts warning the death rate could triple by mid-January. According to data from Johns Hopkins University, there were almost 88,521 new cases of the coronavirus reported in the United States on Thursday, 29th of October, 9,540 more cases than on previous day, Wednesday, 28th of October. In total, there have been about 8,944,934 cases and at least 228,656 deaths in the United States, 971 of those deaths on Thursday. Moreover, the British government will close the furlough scheme in near future, with redundancies rising at the fastest rate on record and the second wave of COVID-19 pushing Britain's economy to the brink of a double-dip recession. As the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Rishi Sunak, prepares to end the multi-billion pound coronavirus job retention scheme and launch a less generous replacement programme, early warning indicators show business activity faltering at local lockdowns take effect. The article you're about to hear has been written by staff at The Guardian newspaper, as well as the Associated Press news agency, under the heading, Europe, US, again epicenter of coronavirus pandemic, it pushing UK to brink of double dip recession. Please stay with us for more.
Welcome
53-country region that makes up Europe under the umbrella of the World Health Organization, WHO, said it reached a record of confirmed cases of COVID-19 with 1.5 million new infections last week. The organization's European director said recently there have been more than 10 million confirmed cases since the pandemic began this year. According to Associated Press, the World Health Organization European Regional Director Hans Kluger said in a meeting with European health ministers, Europe is at the epicenter of this pandemic once again. At the risk of sounding alarmist, I must express our very real concern. Kluger said that deaths have increased by more than 30% in the past week, and hospitalizations have reached the highest level since spring. Explaining that testing systems have been unable to keep up with the influx, Hans Kluger said, test positivity levels have reached new highs. In addition to what is typically considered part of Europe, the World Health Organization's European division includes Russia, as well as Central Asian countries like Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, and Turkmenistan in the 53-country count. Despite the increase in cases, Hans Kluger said, nationwide lockdowns should be viewed as a last resort. He cited the economic toll and effect on mental health as his reasoning behind keeping countries open. Several European countries have begun to take restrictive measures to curb the spread of the virus, including in Germany, the Irish Republic, and France, which have all implemented shutdowns. Kluger warned last month that infections were spreading faster than they were in March and should serve as a wake-up call for everyone. Meanwhile, daily COVID-19 cases in the United States reached a record high on Thursday, 29th of October, with experts warning the death rates could triple by mid-January. According to data from Johns Hopkins University, there were almost 88,521 new cases of the coronavirus reported in the United States on Thursday, 29th of October, 9,540 more cases than the previous day, Wednesday, 28th of October. In total, there have been 8,944,934 cases and at least 228,656 deaths in the United States, 971 of those deaths on Thursday. Dr. Scott Gottlieb, the former commissioner of the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, FDA, said during an interview on CNBC's Squawk Box recently, "This is the hardest point in this pandemic right now, the next 2 months. We can't give up our guard right now." The Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation at the University of Washington School of Medicine said it is more likely that by the middle of January, 2,250 Americans will be dying every day from the coronavirus, three times more than the current rate, and it could even get worse. The Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation at the University of Washington said in its latest forecast, if states do not react to rising numbers of by reimposing mandates, cumulative deaths could reach 514,000 by the same date. The fall winter surge should lead to a daily death toll that is approximately three times higher than now by mid-January. Hospitals, particularly ICUs, intensive care units, are expected to be under extreme stress in December and January in 18 states in the United States. According to the COVID tracking project, hospitals are already under increased strain. As of Thursday, 29th of October, more than 46,000 people were hospitalized, with all but 11 states seeing a rise in hospitalizations this week. Moreover, according to Johns Hopkins University, 43 states have shown an increase in cases compared to last week, with 5 holding steady and 2, Oklahoma and Louisiana, reporting a decline. New Mexico reported 1,082 new coronavirus cases on Thursday, a record, and a top healthcare executive there sounded the alarm bell about the direction of COVID-19 spread in New Mexico. Dr. Jason Mitchell said, "We are at an unsustainable growth rate." Dr. Mitchell is the chief medical officer at Presbyterian Healthcare Services, which operates 9 regional hospitals in New Mexico. Dr. Jason Mitchell said the state's rate of case growth is averaging about 5% a day, which would result in catastrophic numbers if there is no effort to change the trend. Dr. Mitchell said during a state health briefing, by December, we would have so many cases that we would be in MASH or Mobile Army Surgical Hospital tents. The state of Illinois also reported a daily high of new COVID-19 cases for the second time in a week, with about 6,363 new cases on Thursday, 29th of October. According to the Illinois Department of Public Health, the total number of COVID-19 cases statewide now stands at 395,458. The governor of Illinois, J.B. Pritzker, announced that Region 3 would go into COVID-19 mitigation measures. 9 of the state's 11 regions now are under resurgence mitigation measures due to the high average positivity rates of COVID-19 cases. Minnesota, North Dakota, and Ohio also reported their highest daily COVID-19 totals on Thursday, with 2,872, 1,222, and 3,590 new positive cases, respectively. Meanwhile, according to the British newspaper The Guardian, the British government will close the furlough scheme this weekend, with redundancies rising at the fastest rate on record, and the second wave of COVID-19 pushing Britain's economy to the brink of a double-dip recession. As the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Rishi Sunak, prepares to end the multi-billion pound coronavirus job retention scheme and launch a less generous replacement programme, early warning indicators show business activity faltering at local lockdowns take effect. The number of people losing their jobs is rising much faster than during the 2008 financial crisis, whilst the economic fight back from the March lockdown is gradually fading. Faced with official forecasts that suggest unemployment could hit the highest level since the 1980s by Christmas, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Rishi Sunak, was forced into unveiling a last-minute package for business and workers amid anger over lack of state support as a number of new infections rose rapidly. Writing in The Guardian, the Conservative peer David Young, who was Employment Secretary in the second Thatcher government, said people were losing their jobs through no fault of their own and yet have the skills and energy to flourish when conditions return to normal. David Young urged Rishi Sunak to develop new measures to spur job creation. Lord Young said the situation today was different from that in the 1980s, when he said old industries needed to change, but added that help was needed fast. He said the longer people are out of work, the harder it is to get back to employment. Since the outset of the pandemic, The Guardian has chosen 8 economic indicators, as well as the level of the FTSE 100 index, to track the impact on jobs and growth from COVID-19 and the measures used to contain it. Faced with the deepest global recession since the Great Depression of the 1930s, the COVID Crisis Watch also monitors how the United Kingdom is faring compared with other countries. In the past month, official figures show that the United Kingdom economic growth slowed in August despite the government's Eat Out to Help Out scheme, providing a shot in the arm for the struggling hospitality industry. Business activity has since continued to slow at the start of autumn as the number of COVID infections rises and local lockdowns are imposed. In a bright spot for the British economy, this month's dashboard, retail sales have remained resilient as UK consumers, who saved money whilst working from home earlier this year, increased their spending on DIY or do-it-yourself and garden products. House prices have also risen at the fastest rate in 4 years, as people able to afford buying a property reassess their living conditions after lockdown. However, the latest dashboard shows problems are mounting for the economy as a difficult winter draws near. The latest figures from the Office of National Statistics, ONS, show that the number of redundancies almost doubled to 227,000 in the 3 months to August, as the British government started to scale back the furlough scheme and the pandemic fallout forced companies to cut jobs. Headline unemployment rate also increased by the most in a decade to 4.5%, up from 4.1% in July. The Office for Budget Responsibility, the government's economic forecaster, has warned that the jobless rate could hit 12%, about 4 million people out of work before the end of 2020. As the furlough scheme ends on Saturday, 24th of October, when it is replaced by the Less Generous Job Support Scheme, or JSS, the Office for National Statistics said almost 1 in 13 UK workers were still in receipt of wage subsidies from the state, about 2 million people. Against the backdrop of rising unemployment and tougher restrictions across large parts of Northern England, as well as in Scotland, Northern Ireland and Wales, Rishi Sunak has come under increasing pressure to provide further emergency support. The Job Support Scheme, or JSS, will offer workers two-thirds of their wages rather than 80% under furlough. Whilst there are also tougher eligibility criteria for businesses, local leaders and rebellious Conservative MPs representing northern constituencies have called for further financial assistance to protect shuttered businesses in their areas. In a message to the Chancellor, Lord Young, who was an advisor to David Cameron, said the government urgently needed to use state-backed job creation schemes to boost employment opportunities and help people start a business. Lord Young said government should now, for time is very much of the essence, recreate the programs that worked so well in the past, market them actively, and encourage those newly out of work to get together either by themselves or with friends or colleagues and set up their own new businesses.
This is IRIB English Radio. Website is www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
economic divide.
The impact of the COVID-19 virus has no doubt shaken the world in a way not seen before, with the tragic loss of life of over 1 million people so far being the heaviest price to pay. Yet for many developing and global South nations, a huge dilemma exists, and it's one that has been created by the richer and global North states, who are mostly to blame. So what is the problem? It's having to choose between paying back debts or providing much-needed healthcare, and it's something that major institutions such as the IMF have taken into consideration by asking the lending countries to ease the repayment plans in order for developing nations to concentrate their efforts on problems at home.
I want to finish with the gratitude to the G20 for exceptionally rapid decision on debt relief for the poorest countries. It would release billions of dollars for them. And that is exactly what we need, solidarity, so we can come through this together.
Yet, there is a huge problem. In spite of the efforts of the lenders to ease repayment, however big or small that may be, there is the issue of how the money being saved is being spent, with allegations emerging that mismanagement and corruption means the money is not reaching those whom it should be. Hello and welcome to Economic Divide with me, Omid Roshando. On this week's show, we'll be taking a look at how developing nations are struggling with debt to world institutions and other countries and examining whether debt relief is truly being used to treat other major crises that the world is currently facing. Now, let's take a look at some of the examples of why debt relief could help some of the nations in Africa in particular when it comes to dealing with the ongoing medical crisis caused by the coronavirus. Kenya, for example, one of the more developed nations in Africa, only has 150 intensive care beds for a population of 50 million people, raising the question as to just how bad things must be elsewhere across the continent. A shortage of doctors is also a major problem for African nations, with Tanzania, for example, having just one doctor per 70,000 people, and Ghana having less than 15% of the number of doctors it needs. Yet Ghana is currently paying debts of $36.3 million per week, enough to pay salaries of an extra 1,500 doctors per year. Now, taking it one stage further, and nurses are also in dire shortage across Africa, with the Democratic Republic of the Congo, for example, having half the number of nurses it requires, with the amount of debt being paid back in just 4 months of the year, enough to employ a further 141,000 nurses per year in the country. Figures that I'm sure you will all agree are truly startling.
There's no doubt that when it comes to any kind of debt, there's a major common denominator that determines it. Namely, one rich party will lend to a poor party, on the condition of usually high interest rates and some kind of notion of set conditions to pay it back, which for the most part often sees the party owing money, rarely able to fully pay it back, hence finding itself in a position to be exploited. One of the most prominent examples of debt is seen in developing nations, who have borrowed vast amounts of money from more developed countries, who in turn use the debt to exploit land, resources and people into paying back the loans. Africa is of course one such place where such debt exists. But how then did African nations find themselves in such positions?
I think one point is that countries are encouraged to borrow. You know, that lenders exist and they want to lend money. The big difference for African countries is whether the borrowing is from multilateral institutions like the World Bank or the IMF or industrialized countries where it's concessional, or whether it's from the private sector.
When one looks at the statistics for Africa, the figures are truly worrying for the nations, with external debts doubling on average across the continent from 5.9% in 2015 up to 11.8% and rising currently. Of this debt, around 20% of total African debt is owed to China, of which 17% of African government external interest payments alone are paid to the Chinese. However, this only reflects the debts owed to nation states. In fact, the problem is equally big when it comes to private loans, with around 32% of African government external debt being owed to private lenders, and a further 35% being owed to multilateral institutions such as the IMF and World Bank. The demographics of African debt is also an interesting point to discuss, with the whole continent owing around $283 billion. However, 42% of this debt, which equates to around $119 billion, has been loaned to North African countries, with the likes of Egypt, Algeria, and Morocco all heavily in debt to lenders.
So how big a problem is debt repayment on a global scale? In 2018, external debt accumulated to a staggering $457 billion. In 2020 alone, the 76 poorest nations in the world are due to pay $40.6 billion, leaving little room for the world's poorest nations to concentrate any of their efforts on fighting and treating the COVID-19 pandemic. Since the start of the pandemic, over $23.5 billion has been repaid by the world's poorest countries to banks and other nations. With the money being spent by poor nations on their debts, it has been calculated that failure to act on the coronavirus could claim 40 million lives worldwide, and for those that survive, 500 million more people could fall into poverty. However, the global debt problem is not just one that affects the poorer nations, with the world's richest nations also seeing themselves plunge into debt, with around $17 trillion worth of extra public debt, which when adjusted to an individual level, could see 1.3 billion people around the world's most developed nations fall $13,000 into debt each as governments raise taxes to repay the debts.
We've already ascertained that poor nations remain poor, partly due to their massive debts owed to lenders. However, there's also a flip side to the coin, namely, more developed and richer nations being in debt themselves. Take, for example, the United States of America, who, as things stand, enjoys the title of the world's largest economy. The national debt in the US at the time of writing exceeds $27 trillion, which equates to around $82,500 per person. A quick look at the US national debt website clock will show you just how alarmingly fast the debt is rising. When one looks at some other richer nations around the world, the debt figures are equally shocking, with the average debt versus GDP ratio standing at around 68.9% globally. Broken down, these figures per nation are quite staggering, with China, for example, at 55.6%, the US at 106%, India at 69%, and worst of all, Japan at 237.7% in debt versus its GDP. For many of the other richer nations around the world, the impact of the coronavirus has also added fuel to the fire in many situations, with production and consumption down, leaving the pieces yet to be collected from the spilt puzzle. So will such nations recover when it comes to being in such debt?
The financial institutions are based in the developed countries, the rich countries. So there's greater confidence in the ability of industrialized countries to, at some point in the future, repay the debt. Now, it may be misplaced confidence, and there is an element that, you know, that the huge debt burden that the US has is not really the US's problem, it's everybody else's problem because they've lent it. So, you know, the big countries, especially because they're where the financial institutions are based, they can get away with things that other countries can't manage to get away with.
When one analyzes the impact of debt, there's a shocking truth in the matter, namely, where the rich borrow, the poor repay. This is clearly the case in examples seen around the world, with Western or Global North developed nations seeing huge debt crises, much like the one seen in 1982 and 2009. And even throughout the current financial collapse caused by the pandemic, the consequences are often felt by the poorest nations. One of the main causes of such financial crises is the effect it has on poverty in developing nations, as the rich divert their attention towards themselves. According to UNICEF, as a direct result of the financial bubble bursting in the 1980s, over 500,000 children under the age of 5 died each year in Africa and Latin America as a direct result of the debt crisis and its management under the IMF. The Asian crisis threw millions of people into extreme poverty. In Indonesia, for example, over 30 million people dropped below the $1 per day benchmark, resulting in hunger, illness, and death. It seems then that the burden of debt affects poorer nations twofold compared to richer nations, as not only do they have to deal with their own financial commitments, but when things go bad elsewhere, it seems that the trickle-down effect ultimately knocks on the door of the poor, leaving the economic divide greater than ever.
It's a great honor to say that joining me in the studio today is Hakeem Adi, a professor of the history of Africa and African diaspora from Chichester University. His research interests Pan-Africanism to the modern political history of Africa. He was a founder member of the Black and Asian Studies Association, and he also leads the History Matters group. His works include West Africans in Britain from 1900 to 1960, and Pan-Africanism and Communism. He has also worked on the multi-award-winning documentary, 500 Years Later. Professor, many thanks for being here with us today.
Thanks for inviting me.
My first question then relates to the position that many African nations find themselves in, namely highly indebted to richer nations and global financial institutions. Can you give our viewers a brief introduction as to how African nations found themselves in this position?
Well, I think the easiest way of understanding that is to think about the colonial period and the kind of economies that most African countries had during that period. And the fact is that even though we're 60 or 70 years after most African countries gained independence, their economies are still geared to generally producing products for export, raw materials of various kinds for export. They're still highly dependent on global markets. They're still highly dependent on an economy which is skewed against them and operates in the favor of the big powers, the G20 countries and others. Many of them are in debt for a variety of reasons. They needed to borrow to produce and develop infrastructural developments of various kinds. And so they're really in a dependent situation with the major economies of the world, the economies of the EU, the US, and other major powers.
Okay, next up then, with the current global coronavirus pandemic having such a devastating effect on the people of the world, how then are nations in Africa coping with the virus? And when it comes to paying back debt, are the lenders giving enough space to African nations to concentrate on dealing with the pandemic as a priority over debt repayment?
Well, I think you could say that most African countries have probably dealt with the COVID pandemic better than some of the wealthier countries. If we think of countries like the US and Britain that haven't coped very well, most African countries, with one or two exceptions, have far fewer cases of the virus and far fewer deaths. Having said that, they still need to apportion some of their budgets to health and other programs of that kind, and so many of them are still struggling. Some have to decide between debt repayments and spending more on health and other forms of social care, so there's still a problem. There have been some efforts by the big lenders, by G20 and others, to mitigate the circumstances regarding debt payments, but for a variety of reasons, most African countries haven't taken up those offers.
And finally, what does the future hold for African nations in a post-pandemic period? As we have seen, there is much interest from nations such as China when it comes to investing in Africa. Is this something that Africa should embrace or, in fact, should be wary of?
I think Africa should be very wary of it. Again, it all depends on the relationship between African countries and lenders. And if that relationship is one of dependency, it's not really a good thing for African countries. It also, of course, depends on what these investments are for, what African governments are borrowing for, But generally, these kinds of arrangements tend to keep Africa's economies dependent on other countries, whether those are the countries of the West, so-called, the EU, the US, or big emerging powers like China.
Many thanks, Professor Adi from the University of Chichester. It's been great having you on the show.
You're welcome anytime.
We're about to take a quick break here on Economic Divide, but don't go anywhere, as we have plenty more coming. We're joined by researcher and journalist Atefet Hadidar as she runs us through some of her findings on the topic from the world of social media. We also delve into the global pandemic and ascertain just how bad things are in developing nations around the world, as well as examining whether foreign direct investment is a benefit or a burden to developing nations. So don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
We've already touched on the notion that the coronavirus has caused one of the world's worst financial collapses in history, with a real possibility of a global depression on the cards for many nations, and for those that are lucky, maybe just a prolonged recession. But for nations in the global south and still in development, how has the impact of the virus affected them? For a start, with the notion of existing debt hanging over their shoulders, tough choices have had to be made, namely, the choice between paying back debt or paying towards its internal infrastructure, particularly in the field of healthcare, to be able to provide much-needed services to the sick and needy. For many African nations, for example, the lack of access to equipment such as ventilators, doctors, and other forms of healthcare is a huge dilemma, and one that requires the lenders to waive their fees, hence allowing such nations to concentrate on treating and defeating the virus. When one looks at the current spending on fighting the coronavirus, never more has there been such a time to demand that lenders